This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. One of our listeners wrote to me about the people who now own Chadwick's Gardens. It's now Willard Bay Gardens. And I had read from an essay I had written about Mr. Chadwick. This is the story about Della, who now owns Willard Bay Gardens. And he tells about how she is continuing in the spirit of Byron Chadwick. On one occasion, he says, I watched as she cut the blossoms off a beautiful group of plants. I wasn't familiar with that plant and asked why she pruned it in that manner, thinking that maybe it was for the health or future health of the plant. Her response was interesting. I take the blossoms off because I don't want the next few customers who walk in to buy it just because it's in beautiful blossom now. She explained this was a rare plant and it deserved an owner who would recognize its rarity, beauty, and special needs. In other words, I believe, she said, the person who owns this plant needed to understand the stewardship he should give if he purchased the plant. Another local friend who teaches in the English department where I once taught provided, without knowing, material for what I want to talk about today. And that isn't petals and prose, but weeds and garden pests that every gardener has to contend with. I want to read a few passages from Evelyn Funda's newly published book called Weeds, A Farm Daughter's Lament, which is almost a mystery story, even though it's nonfiction, because she's trying to unearth the deeper and truer truths about her parents' lives. Her mother had escaped from her native Czech homeland in the bottom of a wine barrel. That was when the Nazi occupation was in force, and so she was able to leave Czechoslovakia and eventually come to the United States, and where she and her husband had a farm in Idaho. And the book called Weeds, a lot of the chapters are the names of weeds: daughter, loose strife, wild oats, cheatgrass, and the one I wanted to talk about, Dyer's Woad. She tells about how, for some people, a weed is not a bad thing, but a good thing. And this reminds me of a quotation from George Washington Carver, who said that a weed is a flower growing in the wrong place. So Evelyn Funda takes the same tack, claiming that having read a book written when she was just a little girl by Joseph Conkener entitled Weeds, Guardians of the Soil, claiming as the first book written in praise of weeds. Conkener dares to suggest that weeds may well be of inestimable value to mankind. As perspective like this one, he argues, weeds perform a number of valuable services, for instance, transforming alkaline hardpan soil into tillable and depleted topsoil. These services are so valuable that he advocates the perspective of looking at weeds benignly as companion plants, partners that can actually nurture healthy growth in crops, mother weeds, he calls them. And then she gives an example, the example of Dyer's Woad, which to some people is a great virtue of a plant and to some a real problem. Consider, she says, the plaintive name of Dyer's Woad, a plant that decorates empty lots and mountainsides alike near my northern Utah home with waist-high foliage and neon yellow sprays of cheerful flowers that sway in canyon winds. Although its name suggests an unhappiness so dreadful that it took a redundancy to express it, I used to think it was Dyer's Woe. The yellow-flowered plant's name actually comes from its use, dating back to medieval times as a natural way to dye fabric. Oddly enough, a beautiful violet blue that we call French blue. With a distinguished history, Dyer's Woad is considered an elite dye in Europe, where royalty were buried in woad-dyed cloth. In the Blue Triangle, the region of southern France, it was said during the Middle Ages that those who cultivated woad would simply lie back in the sun and watch their money grow. And I have a French-Hungarian friend who confirmed that Dyer's Wode really made southern France wealthy. Yet, going back to Evelyn Funda's book, she says, yet in the Rocky Mountain region, this very same plant is the villain with the price on its head. Cultivating it is illegal, and farming-related agencies consider it a dangerous, invasive weed that has caused millions of dollars of damage to ecosystems, abutting cropland. County extension agencies urge citizens to report it to a weed hotline when they see the plant spreading into new territories. A cooperative of Idaho and Northern Utah weed management agencies have even set up a bounty system for collection of the Wode plants pulled or dug up from rural areas, and they aim their Bag of Wode programs to children by distributing colorful pamphlets punctuated with promises of riches, $10 per 40-pound bag, and a series of ominous puns about having Wode rage and being a Wode warrior. The same plant that is revered in the south of France is vilified, where I live. There's also the consideration every gardener has, not only of weeds, but of pests. I have a favorite book called Clementine in the Kitchen, where an American couple living in the south of France hire a cook, Clementine, and what is a terrible pest to us is a great find for Clementine, and I'll read you just a little bit of that. Within the week after Clementine came to preside over our kitchen in Senlis, the Beck family realized what a treasure it had found. One cool evening after her dishes were washed, we watched Clementine take an exploratory stroll in the garden, a rather picturesque bit of rural architecture with a steep roof. It had been a rainy day and the ground was humid under her feet as she disappeared around the corner wall. Suddenly she came into view again, visibly excited. She rushed up to us wide-eyed and then gulped and regained her composure before breaking the news. Mais madame, vous avez des escargots dans votre jardin. Well, excuse my French, but she has just said, madam, you have snails in your garden. This breathless information came as a thunderbolt to the Beck family. We rushed down to the garden in the semi-obscurity. An incredible evening promenade of snails greeted us, dozens and hundreds of them, deserting their daytime retreats in the deep recesses of the wall. They had come out in droves. They clung to the branches of our dwarf pear trees like baubles on a Christmas tree. Anyway, the family gathered these snails and put them in cardboard boxes, because, as Clementine explains, she can't cook them yet. They must fast themselves. They should be kept captive for a week, and then we can prepare them. And so, to give the snails enough parading space to divest themselves of their impurities, Clementine hit upon the idea of allotting a cardboard shoebox to each 3 or 4 dozen snails. Then one night, about midnight, they heard strange crackling noises arose intermittently from the kitchen. Philosoph, the family cat, usually a phlegmatic animal, seemed disturbed and made restless sounds. When finally we padded downstairs in our slippers, a rare sight awaited us. Every one of our snails was on parade. Many of them had loftier aspirations and were proceeding up the walls and across the ceiling. Here the traction was not so good, apparently, and the snails lost their grip and had fallen to the floor, shell and all, making the peculiar crackling noise that had waked us upstairs. It took an hour of ingenious acrobatics and cautious stepping about to contain truant flight, but finally we had them all assembled, except for the cracked and fallen ones, in a well-sealed wooden crate. When it came time to prepare a petit gris, I was curious about the authoritative recipe that Clementine knew about. With a troubled look, she brought out her green covered cookbook and gave it to me. It's here, monsieur, and it is very good. But I should warn you that monsieur who wrote the recipe is long-winded and full of silly words, and I think he's something of a farceur. She meant that the recipe was florid, which again refers to both flowers and language. The recipe that greeted my astonished eyes is such a unique document that I can't resist sharing it with you. It is written by Georges Lecomte. With only a few deletions, here is a fairly accurate translation. Escargot de Bourgogne. If you ambush them in the morning while they are parading nonchalantly on a humid leaf, when their slow, fleshy promenade makes one think of the throat of a voluptuous woman shuddering under a gross and clumsy caress, the snail, sticky and thick, carries its light shell with a facetious air and projects or contracts its horns so lasciviously elastic as the mood pleases them. He irritates you with the little tactics of a gluttonous beast, rampant on his well-filled stomach, everlastingly the same greedy quest. So he tells about, the recipe continues, you next cloister your snail in a cool cellar, and regardless of its own ideas of hygiene, you invariably nurse him for 8 days on green and succulent lettuce, is exactly as you stuff a nursing mother with lentils in order to have better milk, even though the good woman is regarding such fattening fare. On such favorable tidbits, our beasts are to enrich themselves, and what noble flesh it makes, rich, velvety, worthy of a princely banquet. Finally, having arrived at the paroxysm of murder, you contemplate these soft, submissive snails, and as one possessed of a cruel frenzy, you strip their green outer skins. All that remains for you is a delicate routine of an artist, a sumptuous chef, c'est charmant. A radiant copper casserole spread out, this flesh has ceased to suffer, accompanied by the traditional bouquet garni of bay leaf, parsley, and thyme. Well, the recipe goes on in this florid manner, and I recommend to you a delightful book, Clementine in the Kitchen by Samuel Chamberlain. This is Helen Cannon with words about weeds and pests with Petals and Prose.